At the very least, the magician supposed that their doom was being slowly recited to them. But it was not at all clear what language the voice was speaking. Once, Mr. Segundus thought he heard a word that sounded like maleficent, and another time, interficere, a Latin word meaning to kill. The voice itself was not easy to understand. It bore not the slightest resemblance to a human voice, which only served to increase the gentleman's fear that fairies were about to appear. It was extraordinarily harsh, deep, and rasping. It was like two rough stones being scraped together, and yet the sounds that were produced were clearly intended to be speech, indeed were speech. The gentleman peered up into the gloom in fearful expectation, but all that could be seen was the small, dim shape of a stone figure that sprang out from one of the shafts of a great pillar and jutted into the gloomy void. As they became accustomed to the queer sound, they recognized more and more words. Old English words and old Latin words all mixed up together, as if the speaker had no conception of these being two distinct languages. Fortunately, this abominable muddle presented few difficulties to the magicians, most of whom were accustomed to unravelling the ramblings and writings of scholars long ago. When translated into clear, comprehensible English, it was something like this.
"Long, long ago," said the voice, 500 years ago or more, on a winter's day at twilight, a young man entered the church with a young girl with ivy leaves in her hair. There was no one else there but the stones. No one to see him strangle her but the stones. He let her fall dead upon the stones, and no one saw but the stones. He was never punished for his sin, because there were no witnesses but the stones. The years went by, and whenever the man entered the church and stood among the congregation, the stones cried out that this was the man who had murdered the girl with the ivy leaves wound into her hair. But no one ever heard us. But it is not too late. We know where he is buried. In the corner of the south transept. Quick, quick, fetch picks, fetch shovels, pull up the paving stones, dig up his bones, let them be smashed with the shovel, dash his skull against the pillars and break it. Let the stones have vengeance too. It is not too late. It is not too late.
Hardly had the magicians had time to digest this and to wonder some more who it was that spoke, when another stony voice began. This time the voice seemed to issue from the chancel, and it spoke only English. Yet it was a queer sort of English, full of ancient and forgotten words. This voice complained of some soldiers who had entered the church and broken some windows. 100 years later, they had come again and smashed a rude screen, erased the faces of the saints, carried off plate. Once they had sharpened their arrowheads on the brim of the font. 300 years later, they had fired their pistols in the chapter house. The second voice did not appear to understand that while a great church may stand for a millennia, men cannot live so long.
"They delight in destruction," it cried, "and they themselves deserve only to be destroyed."
Like the first, this speaker seemed to have stood in the church for countless years and had presumably heard a great many sermons and prayers. Yet the sweetest of Christian virtues, mercy, love, meekness, were unknown to him. And all the while the first voice continued to lament the dead girl with ivy leaves in her hair, and the two gritty voices clashed together in a manner that was very disagreeable. Mr. Thorpe, who was a valiant gentleman, peeped into the chancel alone to discover who it was that spoke.
"It is a statue," he said.
And then the gentlemen of the York Society peered up again into the gloom above their heads in the direction of the first unearthly voice, and this time very few of them had any doubts that it was the little stone figure that spoke, for as they watched, they could perceive its stubby stone arms that it waved about in its distress. Then all the other statues and monuments in the cathedral began to speak and to say in their stony voices all that they had seen in their stony lives, and the noise was, as Mr. Segundus later told Mrs. Pleasance, beyond description. For York Cathedral had many little carved people and strange animals that flapped their wings. Many complained of their neighbours, and perhaps this is not surprising, since they had been obliged to stand together for so many hundreds of years. There were 15 stone kings that stood each upon a stone pedestal in a great stone screen. Their hair was tightly curled, as if it had been put into curl papers and never brushed out, and Mrs. Honeyfoot could never see them without declaring that she longed to take a hairbrush to each of their royal heads. For the first moment of their being able to speak, the kings began quarrelling and scolding each other, for the pedestals were all of a height, and kings, even stone ones, dislike above all things to be made equal to others. There was, besides, a little group of queer figures with linked arms that looked out with stone eyes from atop an ancient column. As soon as the spell took effect, each of these tried to push the others away from him, as if even stone arms began to ache after a century or so, and stone people began to tire of being shackled to each other. One statue spoke what seemed to be Italian. No one knew why this should be, though Mr. Segundus discovered later that it was a copy of a work by Michelangelo. It seemed to be describing an entirely different church, one where vivid black shadows contrasted sharply with brilliant light. In other words, it was describing what the parent statue in Rome could see. Mr. Segundus was pleased to observe that the magicians, though very frightened, remained within the walls of the church. Some were so amazed by what they saw that they soon forgot their fear entirely, and ran about to discover more and more miracles, making observations, writing down notes with pencils and little memorandum books, as if they had forgotten the perfidious document from which today would prevent them studying magic. For a long time, the magicians of York, soon alas to be magicians no more, wandered through the aisles and saw marvels. And at every moment their ears were assaulted by the hideous cacophony of a thousand stone voices all speaking together. In the chapter house, there were stone canopies with many little stone heads with strange headgear that all chattered and cackled together. Here were marvellous stone carvings of 100 English trees, hawthorn, oak, blackthorn, wormwood, cherry and bryony. Mr. Segundus found 2 stone dragons no longer than his forearm, which slipped one after the other over and under and between stone hawthorn branches, stone hawthorn leaves, stone hawthorn roots and stone hawthorn tendrils. They moved, it seemed, with as much ease as any other creature, and yet the sound of so many stone muscles moving together under a stone skin that scraped stone ribs, that clashed against a heart made of stone, and the sound of stone claws rattling over stone branches was quite intolerable, and Mr. Segundus wondered that they could bear it. He observed a little cloud of gritty dust, such as attends the work of a stonecutter, that surrounded them and rose up in the air. And he believed that if the spell allowed them to remain in motion for any length of time, they would wear themselves away to a sliver of limestone. Stone leaves and herbs quivered and shook as if tossed in the breeze, and some of them so far emulated their vegetable counterparts as to grow. Later, when the spell had broken, strands of stone ivy and stone rosebriars would be discovered wound around chairs and lecterns and prayer books where no stone ivy or briars had been before. But it was not only the magicians of the York Society who saw wonders that day. Whether he had intended it or not, Mr. Norrell's magic had spread beyond the cathedral close and into the city. 3 statues from the west front of the cathedral had been taken to Mr. Taylor's workshops to be mended. Centuries of Yorkshire rain had worn down these images, and no one knew any longer what great personages they were intended to represent. At 10:30, one of Mr. Taylor's masons had just raised his chisel to the face of one of these statues, intending to fashion it into the likeness of a pretty saintess. At that moment, the statue cried out aloud and raised its arm to ward off the chisel, causing the poor workman to fall down in a swoon. The statues were later returned to the exterior of the cathedral untouched, their faces worn as flat as biscuits and as bland as butter. Then, all at once, there seemed a change in the sound, and one by one the voices stopped, until the magicians heard the bells of St. Michael le Belfry ring for the half hour again. The first voice, the voice of the little figure high up in the darkness, continued for some time after the others had fallen silent, upon its old theme of the undiscovered murderer. "It's not too late! It's not too late!" until it too fell silent. The world had changed while the magicians had been inside the church. Magic had returned to England, whether the magicians wished it or not. Other changes of a more prosaic nature had also occurred. The sky had filled with heavy snow-laden clouds. These were scarcely grey at all, but a queer mixture of slate blue and sea green. This curious coloration made a kind of twilight, such as one imagines is the usual illumination in fabled kingdoms under the sea. Mr. Segundus felt very tired by his adventure. Other gentlemen had been more frightened than he. He had seen magic, and thought it wonderful beyond anything he had imagined. And yet, now that it was over, his spirits were greatly agitated, and he wished very much to be allowed to go quietly home without speaking to anyone. While he was in this susceptible condition, he found himself halted and addressed by Mr. Norrell's man of business.
"I believe, sir," said Mr. Childermass, "that the society must now be broken up. I'm very sorry for it."
Now, it may have been due entirely to Mr. Segundus's lowness of spirit, but he suspected that in spite of Childermass's manner, which was very respectful, in some other part of Childermass's person, he was laughing at the York magicians. Childermass was one of that uncomfortable class of men whose birth is lowly and who are destined all their lives to serve their betters, but whose clever brains and quick abilities make them wish for recognition and rewards far beyond their reach. Sometimes, by some strange combination of happy circumstances, these men find their own paths to greatness, but more often the thought of what might have been turns them sour. They become unwilling servants and perform their tasks no better or worse than their less able fellows. They become insolent, lose their places, and end badly.
"I beg your pardon, sir," said Childermass, "but I have a question to put to you. I hope you will not think it impertinent, but I would like to know if you ever look into a London paper."
Mr. Segundus replied that he did.
"Indeed. That is most interesting. I myself am fond of a newspaper, but I have little leisure for reading, except such books as come my way in the course of my duties for Mr. Norrell. And what sort of thing does one find in a London paper nowadays? You will excuse my asking, sir, only Mr. Norrell, who never looks at a paper of any sort, put the question to me yesterday, and I did not think myself qualified to answer it."
"Well," said Mr. Segundus, a little puzzled, "there are all sorts of things. What did you wish to know? There are accounts of the actions of His Majesty's Navy against the French, speeches of the government, reports of scandals and divorces. Is this what you meant?"
"Oh, yes," said Childermass. "You explain it very well, sir. I wonder," he continued, growing thoughtful, "whether provincial news is ever reported in the London papers, whether, for example, today's remarkable occurrences might merit a paragraph."
"I do not know," said Mr. Segundus. "It seems to me quite possible, but then, you know, Yorkshire is so far from London. Perhaps the London editors will never get to hear of what has happened."
"Ah," said Mr. Childermass,
and then was silent. Snow began to fall, a few flakes at first, then rather more than a few, until a million little flakes were drifting down from a soft, heavy greenish-grey sky. All the buildings of York became a little fainter, a little greyer in the snow. The people all seemed a little smaller. The cries and shouts, the footsteps and hoofsteps, the creaks of carriages and the slammings of doors were all a little more distant. And all these things became somehow less important, until all the world contained was the falling snow, the sea-green sky, the dim grey ghost of York Cathedral, and Childermass. And all this time, Childermass said nothing. Mr. Segundus wondered what more he required. All his questions had been answered. But Childermass waited and watched Mr. Segundus with his queer black eyes, as if he were waiting for Mr. Segundus to say one more thing, as if he fully expected that Mr. Segundus would say it, indeed, as if nothing in the world were more certain.
"If you wish," said Mr. Segundus, shaking the snow from his cape, "I can remove all the uncertainty from the business. I can write a letter to the editor of the Times, informing him of Mr. Norrell's extraordinary feats."
"Ah, that is generous indeed," said Childermass. "Believe me, sir, I know very well that not every gentleman would be so magnanimous in defeat. But it is no more than I expected, for I told Mr. Norrell that I did not think there could be a more obliging gentleman than Mr. Segundus."
"Not at all," said Mr. Segundus. "It is nothing." The Learned Society of York Magicians was disbanded, and its members were obliged to give up magic, all except Mr. Segundus. And though some of them were foolish and not all of them were entirely amiable, I do not think that they deserved such a fate. For what is a magician to do, who, in accordance with the pernicious agreement, is not allowed to study magic? He idles about his house day after day, disturbs his niece, or wife, or daughter, at her needlework, and pesters the servants with questions about matters in which he never took an interest before, all for the sake of having someone to talk to, until the servants complain of him to their mistress. He picks up a book and begins to read, but he's not attending to what he reads, and he has got to page 22 before he discovers it is a novel, the sort of work which, above all, he most despises, and he puts it down in disgust. He asks his niece, or wife, or daughter, 10 times a day what o'clock it is, for he cannot believe that time can go so slowly. And he falls out with his pocket watch for the same reason. Mr. Honeyfoot, I'm glad to say, fared a little better than the others. He, kind-hearted soul, had been very much affected by the story that the little stone figure high up in the dimness had related. It had carried the knowledge of the horrid murder in its small stone heart for centuries. It remembered the dead girl with the ivy leaves in her hair when no one else did. And Mr. Honeyfoot thought that its faithfulness ought to be rewarded. So he wrote to the dean and to the canons and to the archbishop, and he made himself very troublesome, until these important personages agreed to allow Mr. Honeyfoot to dig up the paving stones of the south transept. And when this was done, Mr. Honeyfoot and the men he had employed uncovered some bones in a leaden coffin, just as the small stone figure had said they would. But then the dean said that he could not authorize the removal of the bones from the cathedral, which was what Mr. Honeyfoot wanted, on the evidence of the little stone figure. There was no precedent for such a thing. Ah, said Mr. Honeyfoot, but there was, you know, and the argument raged for a number of years, and as consequence, Mr. Honeyfoot really had no leisure to repent signing Mr. Norrell's document. Footnote 2. The example cited by Mr. Honeyfoot was of a murder that had taken place in 1279 in the grim moor town of Alston. The body of a young boy was found in the churchyard, hanging from a thorn tree that stood before the church door. Above the door was a statue of the Virgin and Child. So the people of Alston sent to Newcastle, to the castle of the Raven King, and the Raven King sent 2 magicians to make the Virgin and the Jesus Child speak, and say how they had seen a stranger kill the boy, but for what reason they did not know. After that, whenever a stranger came to town, the people of Alston would drag him before the church door and ask, "Is this him?" But always the Virgin and Child replied that it was not. Beneath the Virgin's feet were a lion and a dragon who curled around each other in a most puzzling manner and bit each other's necks. These creatures had been carved by someone who had never seen a lion or a dragon, but had seen a great many dogs and sheep, and something of the character of a dog and sheep had got into his carving. Whenever some poor fellow was brought before the Virgin and Child to be examined, the lion and dragon would cease biting each other and look up like the Virgin's strange watchdogs, and the lion would bark and the dragon would bleat angrily. Years went by, and the townspeople who remembered the boy were all dead, and the likelihood was that the murderer was too. But the Virgin and Child had somehow got into the habit of speaking, and whenever some unfortunate stranger passed within the compass of their gaze, they would still turn their stone heads and say, "It's not him," and Alston acquired the reputation of an eerie place, and people would not go there if they could help it. The library of the Learned Society of York Magicians was sold to Mr. Thorogood of Coffey Yard, but somehow no one thought to mention this to Mr. Segundus, and he only learnt about it in a roundabout fashion when Mr. Thorogood's shopboy told a friend, that was a clerk in Priestley's linen drapers, and the friend chanced to mention it to Mrs. Cockcroft of the George Inn, and she told Mrs. Pleasance, who was Mr. Segundus's landlady. As soon as Mr. Segundus heard of it, he ran down through the snowy streets to Mr. Thorogood's shop, without troubling to put on his hat or coat or his boots. But the books were already gone. He inquired of Mr. Thorogood who had bought them. Mr. Thorogood begged Mr. Segundus's pardon, but he feared that he could not divulge the name of the gentleman. He did not think the gentleman wished his name to be generally known. Mr. Segundus, hatless and coatless and breathless, with waterlogged shoes and mud splashes on his stockings, and the eyes of everybody in the shop upon him, had some satisfaction in telling Mr. Thorogood that it did not signify whether Mr. Thorogood told him or not, for for he believed he knew the gentleman anyway. Mr. Segundus did not lack curiosity about Mr. Norrell. He thought about him a great deal and often talked of him with Mr. Honeyfoot. Footnote 3. To aid his better understanding of Mr. Norrell's character and of Mr. Norrell's magical powers, Mr. Segundus wrote a careful description of the visit to Hurtview Abbey. Unfortunately, he found his memory on this point peculiarly unclear. Whenever he returned to read what he had written, he discovered that he now remembered things differently. Each time he began by crossing out words and phrases and putting in new ones, and he ended by rewriting completely. After 4 or 5 months, he was obliged to admit to himself that he no longer knew what Mr. Honeyfoot had said to Mr. Norrell, or what Mr. Norrell had said in reply, or what he, Mr. Segundus, had seen in the house. He concluded that to attempt to write anything upon the subject was futile, and he threw what he had written into the fire. Mr. Honeyfoot was certain that everything that had happened could be explained by an earnest wish on Mr. Norrell's part to bring back magic to England. Mr. Segundus was more doubtful, and began to look about him to try if he could discover any acquaintance of Norrell's that might be able to tell him something more. A gentleman in Mr. Norrell's position with a fine house and a large estate will always be of interest to his neighbours, and unless those neighbours are very stupid, they will always contrive to know a little of what he does. Mr. Segundus discovered a family in Stonegate who were cousins to some people that had a farm 5 miles from Hurtview Abbey, and he befriended the Stonegate family and persuaded them to hold a dinner party and to invite their cousins to come to it. Mr. Segundus grew quite shocked at his own skill in thinking up these little stratagems. The cousins duly arrived, and were all most ready to talk about their rich and peculiar neighbour who had bewitched York Cathedral. But the beginning and end of their information was that Mr. Norrell was about to leave Yorkshire and go to London. Mr. Segundus was surprised to hear this, but more than that, he was surprised at the effect this news had upon his own spirits. He felt oddly discomfited by it, which was very ridiculous, he told himself. Norrell had never shown any interest in him or done him the least kindness. Yet Norrell was Mr. Segundus's only colleague now. When he was gone, Mr. Segundus would be the only magician, the last magician, in Yorkshire. Chapter 4. The Friends of English Magic, Early Spring, 1807. Consider, if you will, a man who sits in his library day after day, a small man of no particular personal attractions. His book is on the table before him, a fresh supply of pens, a knife to cut new nibs, ink, paper, notebooks, all is conveniently to hand. There is always a fire in the room. He cannot do without a fire. He feels the cold. The room changes with the season. He does not. 3 tall windows open on a view of English countryside, which is tranquil in spring, cheerful in summer, melancholy in autumn, and gloomy in winter, just as English landscape should be. But the changing seasons excite no interest in him. He scarcely raises his eyes from the pages of his book. He takes his exercise, as all gentlemen do. In dry weather, his long walk crosses the park and skirts a little wood. In wet weather, there is his short walk in the shrubbery. But he knows very little of shrubbery or park or wood. There is a book waiting for him upon the library table. His eyes fancy they still follow its lines of type. His head still runs upon its argument. His fingers itch to take it up again. He meets his neighbours 2 or 3 times a quarter, for this is England, where a man's neighbours will never suffer him to live entirely bereft of society, let him be as dry and sour-faced as he may. They pay him visits, leave their cards with his servants, invite him to dine or dance at assembly balls. Their intentions are largely charitable. They have a notion that it is bad for a man to be always alone. But they also have some curiosity to discover whether he has changed at all since they last saw him. He has not. He has nothing to say to them, and is considered the dullest man in Yorkshire. Yet within Mr. Norrell's dry little heart, there was as lively an ambition to bring back magic to England as would have satisfied even Mr. Honeyfoot, and it was with this intention of bringing that ambition to a long-postponed fulfilment that Mr. Norrell now proposed to go to London. Childermas assured him that the time was propitious, and Childermas knew the world. Childermas knew what games the children on street corners are playing, games that all other grown-ups have long since forgotten. Childemas knew what old people by firesides are thinking of, though no one has asked them in years. Childemas knew what young men hear in the rattling of the drums and the tooting of the pipes that makes them leave their homes and go to be soldiers. And he knew the half-egg cup full of glory and the barrel full of misery that await them. Childemas could look at a smart attorney in the street and tell you what he had in his coattail pockets. And all that Childemas knew made him smile, and some of what he knew made him laugh out loud. And none of what he knew wrung from him so much as a halfpenny worth of pity. So when Childemas told his master, "Go to London, go now," Mr. Norrell believed him. "The only thing I do not quite like," said Mr. Norrell, "is your plan to have Segundus write to one of the London newspapers upon our behalf. He is certain to make errors in what he writes. Have you thought of that? I dare say he will try his hand at interpretation. These third-rate scholars can never resist putting in something of themselves. He will make guesses, wrong guesses, at the sorts of magic I employed at York. Surely there is enough confusion surrounding magic without our adding to it. Must we make use of Segundus?"
Childemas bent his dark gaze upon his master and his even darker smile, and replied that he believed they must.
"I wonder, sir," he said, "if you have lately heard of a naval gentleman of the name of Baines."
"I believe I know the man you mean," said Mr. Norrell.
"Ah," said Childemas. "And how did you come to hear of him?"
A short silence.
"Well, then," said Mr. Norrell reluctantly, "I suppose that I have seen Captain Baines's name in one of the newspapers."
"Lieutenant Hector Baines served on the King of the North, a frigate," said Childemas. "At 21 years of age, he lost a leg and two or three fingers in an action in the West Indies. In the same battle, the captain of the King of the North and many of the seamen died. Reports that Lieutenant Baines continued to command the ship and issue orders to his crew while the ship's doctor was actually sawing at his leg are, I dare say, a good deal exaggerated. But he certainly brought a fearfully damaged ship out of the Indies, attacked a Spanish ship full of bounty, gained a fortune, and came home a hero. He jilted the young lady to whom he was engaged and married another. This, sir, is the captain's history as it appeared in the Morning Post. And now I shall tell you what followed. Baines is a northerner like you, sir, a man of obscure birth with no great friends to make life easy for him. Shortly after his marriage, he and his bride went to London to stay at the house of some friends in Seacole Lane, and while they were there, they were visited by people of all ranks and stations. They ate their dinner at Viscountess's tables, were toasted by members of Parliament, and all that influence and patronage can do for Captain Baines was promised to him. This success, sir, I attribute to the general approbation and esteem which the report in the newspaper gained for him. But perhaps you have friends in London who will perform the same services for you without troubling the editors of the newspapers."
"You know very well that I do not," said Mr. Norrell impatiently.
In the meantime, Mr. Segundus laboured very long over his letter, and it grieved him that he could not be more warm in his praise of Mr. Norrell. It seemed to him that the readers of the London newspaper would expect him to say something of Mr. Norrell's personal virtues, and would wonder why he did not. In due course, the letter appeared in the Times, entitled, "Extraordinary Occurrences in York, an Appeal to the Friends of English Magic." Mr. Segundus ended his description of the magic at York by saying that the friends of English magic must surely bless that love of extreme retirement which marked Mr. Norrell's character, for it had fostered his studies and had at last borne fruit in the shape of the wonderful magic at York Cathedral. "But," said Mr. Segundus, "he appealed to the friends of English magic to join him in begging Mr. Norrell not to return to a life of solitary study, but to take his place upon the wider stage of the nation's affairs, and so begin a new chapter in the history of English magic." An appeal to the friends of English magic had a most sensational effect, particularly in London. The readers of the Times were quite thunderstruck by Mr. Norrell's achievements. There was a general desire to see Mr. Norrell. Young ladies pitied the poor old gentleman of York who had been so frightened by him, and wished very much to be as terrified themselves. Clearly, such an opportunity as this was scarcely likely to come again. Mr. Norrell determined to establish himself in London with all possible haste.
"You must get me a house, Childemas," he said.
Get me a house that says to those that visit it that magic is a respectable profession, no less than law, and a great deal more so than medicine.
Childermas inquired dryly if Mr. Norrell wished him to seek out architecture expressive of the proposition that magic was as respectable as the church. Mr. Norrell, who knew there were such things as jokes in the world, or people would not write about them in books, but who had never actually been introduced to a joke or shaken its hand, considered a while before replying at last that, no, he did not think they could quite claim that. So Childermas, perhaps thinking that nothing in the world is so respectable as money, directed his master to a house in Hanover Square, among the abodes of the rich and prosperous. Now, I do not know what may be your opinion, yet to say the truth, I do not much care for the south side of Hanover Square. The houses are so tall and thin, four stories at least, and all the tall, gloomy windows are so regular, and every house so exactly resembles its neighbours, that they have something of the appearance of a high wall blocking out the light. Be that as it may, Mr. Norrell, a less fanciful person than I, was satisfied with his new house, or at least as satisfied as any gentleman could be, who for more than 30 years has lived in a large country house surrounded by a park of mature timber, which is in its turn surrounded by a good estate of farms and woods. A gentleman, in other words, whose eye has never been offended by the sight of any other man's property whenever he looked out of the window.
"It is certainly a small house, Childermas," he said, "but I do not complain. My own comfort, as you know, I do not regard."
Childermas replied that the house was larger than most.
"Indeed," said Mr. Norrell, much surprised.
Mr. Norrell was particularly shocked by the smallness of the library, which could not be made to accommodate one-third of the books he considered indispensable. He asked Childermas how people in London housed their books. Perhaps they did not read. Mr. Norrell had been in London not above 3 weeks, when he received a letter from a Mrs. Godston, a lady of whom he had never heard before.
"I know it's very shocking that I should write to you upon no acquaintance whatsoever, and no doubt you say to yourself, 'Who is this impertinent creature?' I did not know there was such a person in existence, and consider me shockingly bold, etc., etc., but Drawlight is a dear friend of mine, and assures me that you are the sweetest-natured creature in the world, and will not mind it. I am most impatient for the pleasure of your acquaintance, and would consider it the greatest honour in the world if you would consent to give us the pleasure of your company at an evening party on Thursday's night. Do not let the apprehension of meeting with a crowd prevent you from coming. I detest a crowd of all things, and only my most intimate friends will be invited to meet you."
It was not the sort of letter to make any very favourable impression upon Mr. Norrell. He read it through very rapidly, put it aside with an exclamation of disgust, and took up his book again. A short while later, Childermas arrived to attend to the morning's business. He read Mrs. Godston's letter, and inquired what answer Mr. Norrell intended to return to it.
"A refusal," said Mr. Norrell.
"Indeed. And shall I say that you have a prior engagement?" asked Childermas.
"Certainly, if you wish," said Mr. Norrell.
"And do you have a prior engagement?" asked Childermas.
"No,"
said Mr. Norrell.
"Ah," said Childermas. "Then perhaps it is the overabundance of your engagements on the other days that makes you refuse this one. You fear to be too tired?"
"I have no engagements. You know very well that I do not."
Mr. Norrell read for another minute or two, before remarking, apparently, to his book.
"You are still here?"
"I am," said Childermas.
"Well then," said Mr. Norrell, "what is it? What is the matter?"
"I thought you were come to London to show people what a modern magician looks like. It would be a slow business if you were to stay at home all the time."
Mr. Norrell said nothing. He picked up the letter and looked at it.
"Drawlight," he said at last. "What does she mean by that? I know no one of that name."
"I do not know what she means," said Childermas, "but I do know this. At present, it would not do to be too nice."
At 8 o'clock on the evening of Mrs. Godston's party, Mr. Norrell, in his best grey coat, was seated in his carriage, wondering about Mrs. Godston's dear friend, Drawlight, when he was roused to a realization that the carriage was no longer moving. Looking out of the window, he saw a great lamp-lit chaos of people, carriages, and horses. thinking that everyone else must find the London streets as confusing as he did, he naturally fell into the supposition that his coachman and footman had lost their way. And banging on the roof of the carriage with his stick, he cried,
"Davy! Lucas! Did you not hear me say Manchester Street? Why did you not make sure of the way before we set off?"
Lucas, on the box seat, called down that they were already in Manchester Street, but must wait their turn. There was a long line of carriages that were to stop at the house before them.
"Which house?" cried Mr. Norrell.
"The house they were going to," said Lucas.
"No, no, you are mistaken," said Mr. Norrell. "It is to be a small gathering."
But on his arrival at Mrs. Godston's house, Mr. Norrell found himself instantly plunged into the midst of 100 or so of Mrs. Godston's most intimate friends. The hall and reception rooms were crowded with people, and more were arriving at every moment. Mr. Norrell was very much astonished. Yet what in the world was there to be surprised at? It was a fashionable London party, no different from any other that might be held at any of a half a dozen houses across town every day of the week. And how to describe a London party? Candles and lustres of cut glass are placed everywhere about the house in dazzling profusion. Elegant mirrors triple and quadruple the light until night outshines day. Many coloured hothouse fruits are piled up in stately pyramids upon white cloth tables. Divine creatures, resplendent with jewels, go about the room in pairs, arm in arm, admired by all who see them. Yet the heat is overpowering, the pressure and noise almost as bad. There is nowhere to sit and scarce anywhere to stand. You may see your dearest friend in another part of the room. You may have a world of things to tell him. But how in the world will you ever reach him? If you are fortunate, then perhaps you will discover him later in the crush and shake his hand as you are both hurried past each other. Surrounded by cross, hot strangers, your chance of rational conversation is equal to what it would be in an African desert. Your only wish is to preserve your favorite gown from the worst ravages of the crowd. Everybody complains of the heat and the suffocation. Everybody declares it to be entirely insufferable. But if it is all misery for the guests, then what of the wretchedness of those who have not been invited? Our sufferings are nothing to theirs, and we may tell each other tomorrow that it was a delightful party. It so happened that Mr. Norrell arrived at the same moment as a very old lady. Though small and disagreeable-looking, she was clearly someone of importance. She was all over diamonds. The servants clustered around her, and Mr. Norrell proceeded into the house unobserved by any of them. He entered a room full of people, where he discovered a cup of punch upon a little table. While he was drinking the punch, it occurred to him that he had told no one his name, and consequently no one knew he was here. He found himself in some perplexity as to how to proceed. His fellow guests were occupied in greeting their friends, and as for approaching one of the servants and announcing himself, Mr. Norrell felt quite unequal to the task. Their proud faces, an air of indescribable superiority, unnerved him. It was a great pity that one or two of the late members of the Society of York Magicians were not there to see him looking so all forlorn and ill at ease. It might have cheered them up immeasurably. But it is the same with all of us. In familiar surroundings, our manners are cheerful and easy, but only transport us to places where we know no one, and no one knows us, and Lord, how uncomfortable we become. Mr. Norrell was wandering from room to room, wishing only to go away again, when he was stopped in mid-perambulation by the sound of his own name and the following enigmatic words.
"Assures me that he is never to be seen without a mystic robe of midnight blue, adorned with other landish symbols. But Drawlight, who knows this Norrell very well, says that..."
The noise of the room was such that it is to be marvelled at that Mr. Norrell heard anything at all. The words had been spoken by a young woman, and Mr. Norrell looked frantically about him to try and discover her, but without success. He began to wonder what else was being said about him. He found himself standing near to a lady and a gentleman. She was unremarkable enough, a sensible-looking woman of 40 or 50. He, however, was a style of man not commonly seen in Yorkshire. He was rather small, and was dressed very carefully, in a good black coat and linen of a most exquisite whiteness. He had a little pair of silver spectacles that swung from a black velvet ribbon around his neck. His features were very regular and rather good. He had short, dark hair, and his skin was very clean and white, except that about his cheeks there was the faintest suggestion of rouge. But it was his eyes that were remarkable. Large, well-shaped, dark, and so very brilliant as to have an almost liquid appearance. They were fringed with the longest, darkest eyelashes. There were many little feminine touches about him that he had contrived for himself, but his eyes and lashes were the only ones which nature had given him. Mr. Norrell paid good attention to their conversation to discover if they were talking about him.
"The advice that I gave Lady Duncombe about her own daughter," said the small man. "Lady Duncombe had found a most unexceptional husband for her daughter, a gentleman with 900 a year, but the silly girl had set her heart upon a penniless captain in the Dragoons, and poor Lady Duncombe was almost frantic. 'Oh, your ladyship,' I cried the instant that I heard about it, 'make yourself easy. Leave everything to me. I do not set up as any very extraordinary genius, as your ladyship knows, but my odd talents are exactly suited to this sort of thing. Oh, madam, you will laugh when you hear how I contrive matters. I dare say no one else in the world would have thought of such a ridiculous scheme. I took Miss Susan to Gray's in Bond Street, where we both spent a very agreeable morning in trying on necklaces and earrings. She has passed most of her life in Derbyshire and has not been accustomed to really remarkable jewels. I do not think she has ever thought seriously upon such things before. Then Lady Duncombe and I dropped one or two hints that in marrying Captain Hurst she would put it quite out of her power to make such delightful purchases ever again, whereas if she married Mr. Watts, she might make her choice of the best of them. I next took pains to get acquainted with Captain Hurst and persuaded him to accompany me to Boodle's, where, well, I will not deceive you, madam, where there is gambling." The small man giggled. "I lent him a little money to try his luck. It was not my own money, you understand. Lady Duncombe had given it to me for the purpose. We went three or four times, and in a remarkably short space of time, the captain's debts were, well, madam, I cannot see how he will ever get clear of them. Lady Duncombe and I represented to him that it is one thing to expect a young woman to marry upon a small income, but quite another to expect her to take a man encumbered with debts. He was not inclined to listen to us at first. At first he made use of, what shall I say, some rather military expressions, but in the end he was obliged to admit the justice of all we said." Mr. Norrell saw the sensible-looking woman of 40 or 50 give the small man a look of some dislike. Then she bowed very slightly and coldly, and passed without a word away into the crowd. The small man turned in the other direction and immediately hailed a friend. Mr. Norrell's eye was next caught by an excessively pretty young woman in a white and silver gown. A tall, handsome man was talking to her, and she was laughing very heartily at everything he said. "And what if he should discover two dragons, one red and one white, beneath the foundations of the house, locked in eternal struggle, and symbolizing the future destruction of Mr. Godston? I dare say," said the man slyly, "you would not mind if he did." She laughed again, even more merrily than before, and Mr. Norrell was surprised to hear in the next instant someone address her as Mrs. Godston. Upon reflection, Mr. Norrell thought that he ought to have spoken to her, but by then she was nowhere to be seen. He was sick of the noise and sight of so many people, and determined to go quietly away. But it so happened that just at that moment, the crowds about the door were particularly impenetrable. He was caught up in the current of people and carried away to quite another part of the room. Round and round he went, like a dry leaf caught up in a drain. In one of these turns around the room, he discovered a quiet corner near a window. A tall screen of carved ebony inlaid with mother-of-pearl half hid, ah, what bliss was this, a bookcase. Mr. Norrell slipped behind the screen, took down John Napier's, A Plain Discovery of the Whole Revelation of St. John, and began to read. He had not been there very long when, happening to glance up, he saw the tall, handsome man who had been speaking to Mrs. Godston and the small, dark man who had gone to so much trouble to destroy the matrimonial hopes of Captain Hurst. They were discoursing energetically, but the press and flow of people around them was so great that without any ceremony, the tall man got hold of the small man's sleeve and pulled him behind the screen and into the corner which Mr. Norrell occupied. "He is not here," said the tall man, giving each word an emphasis with a poke of his finger in the other's shoulder. "Where are the fiercely burning eyes that you promised us? Where are the trances that none of us can explain? Has anyone been cursed? I do not think so. You have called him up like a spirit from the vasty deep, and he has not come." "I was with him only this morning," said the small man defiantly,
to hear of the wonderful magic that he's been doing recently, and he said that he would come. It is past midnight. He will not come now. The tall man smiled a very superior smile. Confess, you do not know him. Then the small man smiled in rivalry of the other's smile. These two gentlemen positively jousted in smiles, and said, No one in London knows him better. I shall confess that I am a little, very little, disappointed. Ah, cried the tall man, it is the opinion of the room that we have all been most abominably imposed upon. We came here in the expectation of seeing something very extraordinary, and instead we have been obliged to provide our own amusement. His eye happening to light upon Mr. Norrell, he said, That, gentlemen, is reading a book. The small man glanced behind him, and in doing so happened to knock his elbow against a plain discovery of the whole revelation of St. John. He gave Mr. Norrell a cool look for filling up so very small a space with so very large a book. I have said that I am disappointed, continued the small man, but I'm not at all surprised. You do not know him as I do. Oh, I can assure you, he has a pretty shrewd notion of his value. No one can have a better. A man who buys a house in Hanover Square knows the style in which things ought to be done. Ah, yes, he has bought a house in Hanover Square. You had not heard that, I dare say. He's as rich as a Jew. He had an old uncle called Haythornwaite who died and left him a world of money. He has, among other trifles, a good house and a large estate, that of Hertfew Abbey in Yorkshire. Ah, said the tall man dryly, he was in high luck. Rich old uncles who die are in shockingly short supply. Oh, indeed, cried the small man. Some friends of mine, the Griffins, have an amazingly rich old uncle to whom they've paid all sorts of attentions for years and years. But though he was at least 100 years old when they began, he is not dead yet, and it seems he intends to live forever to spite them. And all the Griffins are growing old themselves and dying one by one in a state of the most bitter disappointment. Yet I am sure that you, my dear Lascelles, need not concern yourself with any such vexatious old persons. Your fortune is comfortable enough, is it not? The tall man chose to disregard this particular piece of impertinence, and instead remarked coolly, I believe that gentleman wishes to speak to you. The gentleman in question was Mr. Norrell, who, quite amazed to hear his fortune and property discussed so openly, had been waiting to speak for some minutes past. I beg your pardon, he said. Yes, said the small man sharply. I am Mr. Norrell. The tall man and the small man gave Mr. Norrell two very broad stares. After a silence of some moments, the small gentleman, who had begun by looking offended, had passed through a stage of looking blank and was beginning to look puzzled, asked Mr. Norrell to repeat his name. This Mr. Norrell did, whereupon the small gentleman said, I do beg your pardon, but, which is to say, I hope you will excuse my asking so impertinent a question, but is there at your house in Hanover Square someone all dressed in black with a thin face like a twisted hedge root? Mr. Norrell thought for a moment, and then he said, Childermas. You mean Childermas? Oh, Childermas, cried the small man, as if all was now perfectly plain. Yes, of course. How stupid of me. That is Childermas. Oh, Mr. Norrell, I can hardly begin to express my delight in making your acquaintance. My name, sir, is Drawlight. Do you know Childermas? Asked Mr. Norrell, puzzled. Mr. Drawlight paused. I have seen such a person as I described coming out of your house, and I... Oh, Mr. Norrell, such a noodle I am upon occasion. I mistook him for you. Pray do not be offended, sir. For now that I behold you, I plainly see that whereas he has the wild romantic looks one associates with magicians, you have the meditative air of a scholar. Lascelles, does not Mr. Norrell have the grave and sober bearing of a scholar? The tall man said, without much enthusiasm, that he supposed so. Mr. Norrell, my friend Mr. Lascelles, said Drawlight. Mr. Lascelles made the slightest of bows. Oh, Mr. Norrell, cried Mr. Drawlight. You cannot imagine the torments I have suffered tonight in wondering whether or not you would come. At 7 o'clock my anxieties upon this point were so acute that I could not help myself. I actually went down to the Glasshouse Street boiling cellar expressly to inquire of Davy and Lucas to know their opinions. Davy was certain that you would not come, which threw me, as you may imagine, into the utmost despair.
"Davy in Lucas?" said Mr. Norrell in tones of the greatest astonishment. These, it may be remembered, were the names of Mr. Norrell's coachman and footman.
"Oh, yes," said Mr. Drawlight. "The Glasshouse Street boiling cellar is where Davy and Lucas occasionally take their mutton, as I dare say you know."
Mr. Drawlight paused in his flow of chatter, just long enough for Mr. Norrell to murmur that he had not known that.
"I've been most industriously talking up your extraordinary powers to all my wide acquaintance," continued Mr. Drawlight. "I have been your John the Baptist, sir, preparing the way for you, and I felt no hesitation in declaring that you and I were great friends, for I had a presentiment from the first, my dear Mr. Norrell, that we would be. And as you see, I was quite right. For now here we are, chatting so comfortably to one another."
Chapter 5. Drawlight. Spring to Autumn, 1807. Early next morning, Mr. Norrell's man of business, Childermas, answered a summons to attend his master in the breakfast room. He found Mr. Norrell pale-faced and in a state of some nervous agitation.
"What is the matter?" asked Childermas.
"Oh," cried Mr. Norrell, looking up, "you dare to ask me that? You who have so neglected your duties that any scoundrel may put a watch upon my house and question my servants without fear of disturbance. Aye, and get answers to those questions, too. What do I employ you for, I should like to know, if not to protect me from such impertinence as this?"
Childermas shrugged.
"You mean Drawlight, I suppose?"
A short, astonished silence.
You knew of it?" cried Mr. Norrell. "Good God, man, what were you thinking of? Have you not told me 100 times that in order to secure my privacy, the servants must be kept from gossiping?"
"Oh, certainly," said Childermas. "But I'm very much afraid, sir, that you must give up some of your habits of privacy. Retirement and seclusion are all very well in Yorkshire, but we're not in Yorkshire any more."
"Ah, yes, yes," said Mr. Norrell irritably. "I know that we are not, but that is not the question. Question is, what does this Drawlight want?"
"To have the distinction of being the first gentleman in London to make the acquaintance of a magician. That is all."
But Mr. Norrell was not to be reasoned out of his fears. He rubbed his yellow-white hands nervously together and directed fearful glances into the shadowy corners of the room, as though suspecting them of harbouring other Drawlights all spying upon him.
"He did not look like a scholar in those clothes," he said, "but that is no guarantee of anything. He wore no rings of power or allegiance, but still—"
"I do not well understand you," said Childermas. "Speak plainly."
"Might he not have some skill of his own, do you suppose?" said Mr. Norrell. "Or perhaps he has friends who are jealous of my success. Who are his associates? What is his education?"
Childermas smiled a long smile that went all up one side of his face.
"Oh, you have talked yourself into a belief that he is the agent of some other magician. Well, sir, he is not. You may depend upon me for that. Far from neglecting your interests, after we received Mrs. Godston's letter, I made some inquiries about the gentleman, as many, I dare say, as he has made about you. It would be an odd sort of magician, I think, that employed such a creature as he is. Besides, if such a magician had existed, you would have long since found him out, would you not? And discovering the means to part him from his books and put an end to his scholarship. You have done it before, you know."
"You know no harm of this Drawlight, then?"
Childermas raised an eyebrow and smiled his sideways smile.
"Upon the contrary," he said.
"Ah," cried Mr. Norrell, "I knew it. Well, then, I shall certainly make a point of avoiding his society."
"Why?" asked Childermas. "I did not say so. Have I not just told you that he is no threat to you? What is it to you that he is a bad man? Take my advice, sir, make use of the tool which is to hand."
Then Childermas related to Mr. Norrell what he had discovered about Drawlight, how he belonged to a certain breed of gentlemen only to be met with in London, whose main occupation is the wearing of expensive and fashionable clothes, how they pass their lives in ostentatious idleness, gambling and drinking to excess, and spending months at a time in Brighton and other fashionable watering places, how in recent years this breed seemed to have reached a sort of perfection in Christopher Drawlight. Even his dearest friends would have admitted that he possessed not a single good quality. Footnote 1. He had once found himself in a room with Lady Bessborough's long-haired white cat,
He happened to be dressed in an immaculate black coat and trousers, and was therefore thoroughly alarmed by the cat stalking round and round and making motions as if it proposed to sit upon him. He waited until he believed himself to be unobserved, then he picked it up, opened a window, and tossed it out. Despite falling 3 stories to the ground, the cat survived. But one of its legs was never quite right afterwards, and it always evinced the greatest dislike to gentlemen in black clothes. Despite Mr. Norrell's tuttings and sucking ins of air at every new revelation, there is no doubt that this conversation did him good. When Lucas entered the room 10 minutes later with a pot of chocolate, he was composedly eating toast and preserves and appeared entirely different from the anxious, fretful creature he had been earlier that morning. A loud rap was heard at the door, and Lucas went to answer it. A light tread was next heard upon the stairs, and Lucas reappeared to announce,
"Mr. Drawlight! Ah, Mr. Norrell, how do you do, sir?"
Mr. Drawlight entered the room. He wore a dark blue coat and carried an ebony stick with a silver knob. He appeared to be in excellent spirits, and bowed and smiled and walked to and fro so much that 5 minutes later there was scarcely an inch of carpet in the room that he had not stood upon, a table or chair he had not lightly and caressingly touched, a mirror he had not danced across, a painting that he had not for a moment smiled upon. Mr. Norrell, though, confident now that his guest was no great magician or great magician's servant, was still not much inclined to take Childermas's advice. His invitation to Mr. Drawlight to sit down at the breakfast table and take some chocolate was of the coldest sort. But sulky silences and black looks had no effect upon Mr. Drawlight whatsoever, since he filled up the silences with his own chatter and was too accustomed to black looks to mind them.
"Do you not agree with me, sir, that the party last night was the most charming in the world? Though, if I may say so, I think you were quite right to leave when you did. I was able to go round afterwards and tell everyone that the gentleman that had been just espied walking out of the room was indeed Mr. Norrell. Oh, believe me, sir, your departure was not unobserved. The Honourable Mr. Masham was quite certain he had just caught sight of your esteemed shoulder. Lady Barclay thought she had seen a neat grey curl of your venerable wig. And Miss Fiskerton was quite ecstatic to think that her gaze had rested momentarily upon the tip of your scholarly nose. And the little that they have seen of you, sir, has made them desire more. They long to view the complete man." "Ah," said Mr. Norrell, with some satisfaction.
Mr. Drawlight's repeated assurances that the ladies and gentlemen at Mrs. Godston's party had been utterly enchanted by Mr. Norrell went some way to diminish Mr. Norrell's prejudices against his guest. According to Mr. Drawlight, Mr. Norrell's company was like seasoning. The smallest pinch of it could add relish to the entire dish. Mr. Drawlight made himself so agreeable that Mr. Norrell grew by degrees more communicative.
"And to what fortunate circumstance, sir," asked Mr. Drawlight, "do we owe the happiness of your society? What brings you to London?"
"I have come to London in order to further the cause of modern magic. I intend, sir, to bring back magic to Britain,"
answered Mr. Norrell gravely.
"I have a great deal to communicate to the great men of our age. There are many ways in which I may be of service to them."
Mr. Drawlight murmured politely that he was sure of it.
"I may tell you, sir," said Mr. Norrell, "that I heartily wish this duty had fallen to the lot of some other magician."
Mr. Norrell sighed and looked as noble as his small pinched features would allow. It is an extraordinary thing that a man such as Mr. Norrell, a man who has destroyed the careers of so many of his fellow magicians, should be able to convince himself that he would rather all the glory of his profession belong to one of them. But there is no doubt that Mr. Norrell believed it when he said it. Mr. Drawlight murmured sympathetically. Mr. Drawlight was sure that Mr. Norrell was too modest. Mr. Drawlight could not suppose for a moment that anyone could be better suited to the task of bringing back magic to Britain than Mr. Norrell.
"But I labour under a disadvantage, sir," said Mr. Norrell.
Mr. Drawlight was surprised to hear it.
"I do not know the world, sir. I know that I do not. I have a scholar's love of silence and solitude. To sit and pass hour after hour in idle chatter with a roomful of strangers is to me the worst sort of torment. But I dare say there will be a great deal of that sort of thing. Childermas assures me that there will be."
Mr. Norrell looked wistfully at Drawlight, as if hopeful that Drawlight might contradict him.
"Ah,"
Mr. Drawlight considered a moment,
And that is exactly why I'm so happy that you and I have become friends. I do not pretend to be a scholar, sir. I know next to nothing of magicians or magical history, and I dare say that from time to time you may find my society irksome. But you must set any little irritations of that nature against the great good that I may do you in taking you about and showing you to people. Oh, Mr. Norrell, sir, you cannot imagine how useful I may be to you.
Mr. Norrell declined to give his word there and then to accompany Mr. Drawlight to the places that Mr. Drawlight said were so delightful, and to meet all those people whose friendship, Mr. Drawlight said, would add a new sweetness to Mr. Norrell's existence. But he did consent to go with Mr. Drawlight that evening to a dinner at Lady Rawtenstall's house in Bedford Square. Mr. Norrell got through the dinner with less fatigue than he expected, and so agreed to meet Mr. Drawlight upon the morrow at Mr. Plumtree's house. With Mr. Drawlight as his guide, Mr. Norrell entered society with greater confidence than before. His engagements became numerous. He was busy from 11 o'clock in the morning to past midnight. He paid morning visits. He ate his dinner in dining parlours all over the town. He attended evening parties, balls, and concerts of Italian music. He met baronets, viscounts, viscountesses, and honourable thises and thats. He was to be met with walking down Bond Street arm in arm with Mr. Drawlight. He was observed taking the air in a carriage in Hyde Park with Mr. Drawlight and Mr. Drawlight's dear friend, Mr. Lascelles. On days when Mr. Norrell did not dine abroad, Mr. Drawlight took his mutton at Mr. Norrell's house in Hanover Square, which Mr. Norrell imagined Mr. Drawlight must be very glad to do, for Childermas had told him that Mr. Drawlight had scarcely any money. Childermas said that Drawlight lived upon his wits and his debts. None of his great friends had ever been invited to visit him at home, because home was a lodging above a shoemaker's in Little Rider Street. Like every new house, the house in Hanover Square, which had seemed perfection at first, was soon discovered to be in need of every sort of improvement. Naturally, Mr. Norrell was impatient to have it all accomplished as soon as possible, but when he appealed to Drawlight to agree with him that the London workmen were extraordinarily slow, Drawlight took the opportunity to ascertain all of Mr. Norrell's plans for colours, wallpapers, carpets, furniture, and ornaments, and to find fault with all of them. They argued the point for a quarter of an hour, and then Mr. Drawlight ordered Mr. Norrell's carriage to be got ready and directed David to take him and Mr. Norrell straight to Mr. Ackerman's shop in the Strand. There Mr. Drawlight showed Mr. Norrell a book which contained a picture by Mr. Repton of an empty, old-fashioned parlour where a stony-faced old person from the time of Queen Elizabeth stared out of a painting on the wall, and the empty chairs all gaped at each other like guests at a party who discover they have nothing to say to one another. But on the next page, ah, what changes had been wrought by the noble arts of joinery, paper-hanging, and upholstery. Here was a picture of the same parlour, new furnished and improved beyond all recognition. A dozen or so fashionably dressed ladies and gentlemen had been enticed into the smart new apartment by the prospect of refreshing their spirits by reclining in elegant postures upon the chairs, or walking in the vine-clad conservatory which had mysteriously appeared on the other side of a pair of French windows. The moral, as Mr. Drawlight explained it, was that if Mr. Norrell hoped to win friends for the cause of modern magic, he must insert a great many more French windows into his house. Under Mr. Drawlight's tutelage, Mr. Norrell learned to prefer picture gallery reds to the respectable dull greens of his youth. In the interests of modern magic, the honest materials of Mr. Norrell's house were dressed up with paint and varnish and made to represent things they were not, like actors upon a stage. Plaster was painted to resemble wood, and wood was painted to resemble different sorts of wood. By the time it came to select the appointments for the dining parlour, Mr. Norrell's confidence in Drawlight's taste was so complete that Drawlight was commissioned to choose the dinner service without reference to anyone else.
"You will not regret it, my dear sir," cried Drawlight. "For 3 weeks ago, I chose a set for the Duchess of B, and she declared the moment she saw it that she never in her life saw anything half so charming."
On a bright May morning, Mr. Norrell was seated in a drawing-room in Wimpole Street, in the house of a Mrs. Littleworth. Among the people gathered there was Mr. Drawlight and Mr. Lascelles. Mr. Lascelles was exceedingly fond of Mr. Norrell's society. Indeed, he came second only to Mr. Drawlight in this respect. But his reasons for courting Mr. Norrell's notice were quite different. Mr. Lascelles was a clever, cynical man who thought it the most ridiculous thing in the world that a scullery old gentleman should have talked himself into the belief that he could perform magic. Consequently, Mr. Lascelles took great pleasure in asking Mr. Norell questions about magic whenever the opportunity arose, so that he might amuse himself with the answers.
"And how do you like London, sir?"
he asked.
"Not at all," said Mr. Norrell.
"Ah, I'm sorry to hear it," said Mr. Lascelles. "Have you discovered any brother magicians to talk to?"
Mr. Norrell frowned and said he did not believe there were any magicians in London, or if so, then all his researches had not been able to uncover them.
"Ah, sir," cried Mr. Drawlight, "there you are mistaken. You have been most abominably misinformed. We have magicians in London, oh, 40 at least. Lascelles, would you not agree that we have hundreds of magicians in London? One may see them upon practically every street corner. Mr. Lascelles and I will be very happy to make you acquainted with them. They have a sort of king, whom they call Vinculus, a tall, ragged scarecrow of a man who has a little booth just outside St. Christopher Lestocq's, all splashed with mud, with a dirty yellow curtain, and if you give him 2 pennies, he will prophesy."
"Vinculus's fortunes are nothing but calamities," observed Mr. Lascelles, laughing.
"Thus far, he has promised me drowning, madness, the destruction by fire of all my property, and a natural daughter who will do me great injury in my old age by her spitefulness."
"I shall be glad to take you, sir," said Drawlight to Mr. Norrell.
"I am as fond as anything of Vinculus."
"Take care if you do go, sir," advised Mrs. Littleworth. "Some of these men can put one in a dreadful fright. The Crookshanks brought a magician, a very dirty fellow, to the house to show their friends some tricks. But when he got there, it seemed he did not know any, and so they would not pay him. In a great rage, he swore that he would turn the baby into a coal scuttle. And then they were in great confusion because the baby was nowhere to be found, though no new coal scuttles had appeared, just the old familiar ones. They searched the house from top to bottom, and Mrs. Crookshank was half dead with anxiety, and the physician was sent for, until the nursemaid appeared with the baby at the door, and it came out that she had taken it to show her mother in James Street."
Despite such enticements as these, Mr. Norrell declined Mr. Drawlight's kind offer to take him to see Vinculus in his yellow booth.
"And what is your opinion of the Raven King, Mr. Norrell?" asked Mrs. Littleworth eagerly.
"I have none. He is a person I never think of."
"Indeed," remarked Mr. Lascelles. "You will excuse me saying so, Mr. Norrell, but that is rather an extraordinary statement. I never met a magician who did not declare that the Black King was the greatest of them all, the magician par excellence. A man who could, had he so desired, have wrestled Merlin from the tree, spun the old gentleman on his head, and put him back in again."
Footnote 2. Merlin is presumed to have been imprisoned in a hawthorn tree by the sorceress Nimue. Mr. Norrell said nothing.
"But surely," continued Mr. Lascelles, "none of the other Oreads could rival his achievements? Kingdoms in all the worlds that ever were?"
Footnote 3. Mr. Lascelles exaggerates. The Raven King's kingdoms were never more than 3 in number.
"Ends of human knights and fairy knights to carry out his bidding, magic woods that walked about, to say nothing of his longevity, a 300-year reign, and at the end of it we are told he was still in appearance at least a young man."
Mr. Norrell said nothing.
"But perhaps you think that the histories lie. I have frequently heard it suggested that the Raven King never existed, that he was not one magician at all, but a whole train of magicians, all looking much the same. Perhaps that is what you think."
Mr. Norrell looked as if he would prefer to remain silent, but the directness of Mr. Lascelles' question obliged him to give a reply.
"No," he said at last. "I am quite certain that he existed, but I cannot consider his influence upon English magic as anything other than deplorable. His magic was of a particularly pernicious sort, and nothing would please me more than that he should be forgot as completely as he deserves."
"And what of your fairy servants, sir?" said Mr. Lascelles. "Are they visible only to yourself, or may other people perceive them?"
Mr. Norrell sniffed and said he had none.
"What? None?" exclaimed a lady in a carnation pink gown, much surprised.
"You are wise, Mr. Norrell," said Mr. Lascelles. "The Tubbs versus Starhouse must stand as a warning to all magicians."
Footnote 4. Tubbs versus Starhouse, a famous case brought before the Quarter Sessions at Nottingham a few years ago. A Nottinghamshire man called Tubbs wished very much to see a fairy, and from thinking of fairies day and night, and from reading all sorts of odd books about them,
he took it into his head that his coachman was a fairy. The coachman, whose name was Jack Starhouse, was dark and tall and scarcely ever said a word, which discomforted his fellow servants and made them think him proud. He had only recently entered Mr. Tubbs' household and said that previously he had been a coachman to one old man called Brown at a place called Coldmickle Hill in the north. He had one great talent. He could make any creature love him. The horses were always very willing when he had the reins and never cross or fidgety at all, and he could command cats in a way that people of Nottinghamshire had never seen before. He had a whispering way of talking to them. Any cat he spoke to would stay quite still with an expression of faint surprise on its face, as if it had never heard such good sense in all its life, nor ever expected to again. He could also make them dance. The cats that belonged to Mr. Tubbs' household were as grave and mindful of their dignity as any other set of cats, but Jack Starhouse could make them dance wild dances, leaping about on their hind legs and casting themselves from side to side. This he did by strange sighs and whistlings and hissings. One of the other servants observed that if only cats had been good for anything, which they were not, then all this might have had some point to it. But Starhouse's wonderful mastery was not useful, nor did it entertain his fellow servants. It only made them uncomfortable. Whether it were this or his handsome face with the eyes a little too wide apart that made Mr. Tubbs so certain he was a fairy, I do not know. But Mr. Tubbs began to make inquiries about the coachman in secret. One day, Mr. Tubbs called Starhouse to his study. Mr. Tubbs said that he had learnt that Mr. Brown was very ill, had been ill for all the time Starhouse had claimed to work for him, and had not gone out for years and years. So Mr. Tubbs was curious to know what he had needed a coachman for. For a little while, Jack Starhouse said nothing. Then he admitted that he had not been in Mr. Brown's employ. He said he had worked for another family in the neighbourhood. He had worked hard, it had been a good place, he had been happy, but the other servants had not liked him. He did not know why. It had happened to him before. One of the other servants, a woman, had told lies about him, and he'd been dismissed. He had seen Mr. Brown once, years ago. He said he was very sorry that he had lied to Mr. Tubbs, but he had not known what else to do. Mr. Tubbs explained that there was no need to invent further stories. He knew that Starhouse was a fairy, and said he was not to fear. He would not betray him. He only wished to talk to him about his home and people. At first, Starhouse did not understand what Mr. Tubbs meant, and when finally he did understand, it was in vain that he protested that he was a human being and an Englishman. Mr. Tubbs did not believe him. After this, whatever Starhouse was doing, wherever he went, he would find Mr. Tubbs waiting for him with 100 questions about fairies and fairy. Starhouse was made so unhappy by this treatment, though Mr. Tubbs was always kind and courteous, that he was obliged to give up his place. While yet unemployed, he met with a man in an alehouse in Southwell, who persuaded him to bring an action against his former master for defamation of character. In a famous ruling, Jack Starhouse became the first man to be declared human under English law. But this curious episode ended unhappily for both Tubbs and Starhouse. Tubbs was punished for his harmless ambition to see a fairy by being made an object of ridicule everywhere. Unflattering caricatures of him were printed in the London, Nottingham, Derby, and Sheffield papers, and neighbours with whom he'd been on the terms of the greatest goodwill and intimacy for years declined to know him any more. While Starhouse quickly discovered that no one wished to employ a coachman who had brought an action against his master, he was forced to accept work of a most degrading nature, and very soon fell into great poverty. The case of Tubbs versus Starhouse is interesting not the least because it serves as an illustration of the widely held belief that fairies have not left England completely. Many Englishmen and women think that we are surrounded by fairies every day of our lives. Some are invisible, and some masquerade as Christians, and may in fact be known to us. Scholars have debated the matter for centuries, but without reaching any conclusion.